Welcome to the full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:45 p.m. the Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 24th. There are a number of headlines out there that are occupying the minds of investors, and it's, I think, important at this particular stage to think about longer-term themes. This, of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There are the short-term fears there, and then there are the long-term potential outcomes. So the short-term thing that everyone is worried about is the coronavirus. And the big question from an investor's perspective is, how successful is China going to be in containing it within its borders? We saw that the USA had its second case today. France had its first case. Singapore had its first case yesterday. There has been evidence that the disease has been jumping from people across, that haven't been to Wuhan, so that there is a trajectory for greater infection rates. Then there have been instances where people have not been exhibiting a high temperature. There was somebody from the CDC I saw quoted today saying that thermometers and video thermometers or infrared cameras that they have in airports are basically cosmetic. They're just used as a way to show people that governments are trying to do something, that the only way to really contain this kind of disease is constant monitoring and quarantine. Well, what we can definitely see is that the offshore renminbi posted a downside key reversal against the dollar today. So the dollar was up in a reasonably dynamic manner. I'm not sure to what extent the offshore renminbi is going to trade next week. I suspect it's probably going to follow the same holiday schedule as Hong Kong. The mainland market is already shut and it will not open again until the week after next. So the Chinese New Year holiday starts this evening and really goes into full swing tomorrow. So Happy New Year to all of our Chinese subscribers, or anyone who is celebrating Chinese New Year, Gong Xi Fa Sai, and I certainly wish everybody a happy, long and uneventful life and a good fortune to go with it. But the reality here is that China is facing some significant challenges, and it's not especially auspicious kicking off the new year with a quarantine. When we look at the potential here, there's obviously scope for some further weakening of the renminbi. And ahead of the holiday, the Chinese stock market had been selling off. Now, there is the potential that the quarantine and the basically the shutting down of cities where you have a population of upwards of 40 million people is obviously going to have an economic effect. The much bigger question is, how is that likely to affect the banking sector, and most particularly the regional banks, considering that Wuhan is a regional city and Hubei province is what would be considered a regional province, certainly not on the coast. Then the question is, what is that going to do to the balance sheets of a number of these banks that are teetering with the weight of non-performing loans? So that does suggest that the central government is going to have to get pretty aggressive with economic stimulus once they've got past the crisis stage of this outbreak and look to try and reinvigorate the economy once more. We're probably not there just yet, and they certainly have a window of opportunity to try and do something substantive over the next week while the stock market is in fact shut. But it does offer other traders to express a view. And what we are starting to see is that gold is starting to firm. Then also silver was up in a reasonably impressive manner in here today. It was up 27 cents. And There is the scope here that we have seen a low of near-term significance. Platinum prices are back above the $1,000 area. I think there's more than one reason for that, but it was so far holding this move above $1,000. It's been up one day, down the next over the course of the last week, but this is the first time in at least the last few years that it has been able to in fact sustain the move above $1,000. Now obviously there have been occasions back in 2017 through 18 when it did do the same thing and was unable ultimately to hold the gain. So the true determining factor here is not so much that it has pushed above 1,000, but whether it can in fact hold it. I do think that the likelihood of it being able to hold it is increasing, and I think there are a couple of different reasons for that, and I will talk more about that when we get to talk more about the energy sector. But when we then just, for the moment, let's focus on the safe havens that are doing well. So gold and the precious metals are definitely firming in response to angst about the coronavirus outbreak from China. 10-year Treasury yields have also firmed, and the 10-year now has broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. It could bounce on Monday, and if it does, then that would certainly be comforting to the bears. But the chart here looks like a period of strengthening in the yield is unfolding. We had the really quite wide overextension relative to the trend mean completely unwound. Clear evidence then of resistance being found, and now it is breaking down and breaking the little uptrend that's been underway for the last 4 months. The big question that is sitting out there on the horizon is whether we are in fact going to have an inflationary scare or whether we're still in an outright deflationary environment. And the actions of the Federal Reserve in providing untold liquidity over the course of the last 4 or 5 months are probably having a distorting effect. When we look at the 3-month bill, it's not only a few basis points away from the 150 area. This is problematic because the Fed funds rate is at 1.75, but of course the Federal Reserve quotes its reserve rate in a band. The lower bound of that band is at 1.5%. And the reason that it's at the lower side of that bound right now is because of the massive quantity of liquidity that the Federal Reserve has supplied to the repo market. And what that has in fact resulted in has been this huge amount of liquidity pumping up asset prices, but what it has also done has been to depress yields, and particularly on the short end of the curve. The reason that they're saying that this is not quantitative easing is because they're buying short dated paper rather than long dated paper, which is the kind of sophistry one would really expect from a philosophy department rather than the Federal Reserve, but I think that's probably a discussion for another time. What they have definitely done in terms of affecting the repo market has been to depress the impression that there's going to be any kind of rate hike. So that is pretty much off the table. There's absolutely no way the Federal Reserve is going to be hiking interest rates in an election year, and particularly when the Federal Reserve chairman was appointed by the incumbent. So that is probably MMT light, I would say, is probably the best way of thinking about it. It's not like we don't have examples of modern monetary theory being deployed in the past. I think a number of the bigger investment managers have been harking back to the 1930s and making the clear comparison that monetization of government debt has been deployed before and has had rather deleterious effects, but it is not a new phenomenon. But there is also, of course, the US 4-year presidential cycle, and generally in the first year they clean the Augean stables, and that is one of the worst years in terms of stock market performance generally. The second year is a bit better. The third year, and the second year is generally a little better because of the midterm elections. Then, as they start to gear up for the presidential election, you generally do get a growth scare in the first half of the third year, because the Federal Reserve has been tightening for the previous 18 months. That generally corresponds with them deciding that they're going to loosen policy. The loosening policy has a lagged effect on the economy, so that the fourth year is generally the best performer, but the stock market generally bottoms in the at the end of the first half of the third year. Well, in this occasion, it was probably very much coinciding with the size of the Fed's balance sheet starting to increase again from September. Then politicians prime the pump ahead of the economy. The incumbent, regardless of what party they're from, they have got a clear and vested interest in ensuring that the economy is singing by the time it gets around to the election, and they print and spend with abandon in order to try and to get that done. And they are facilitated in that action by the Federal Reserve. The reason that the US presidential cycle has been such a factor is because it's real. And the monetization of government debt, whether it is on a light basis or on a heavy basis, is nonetheless assistance. What I find particularly interesting today is we've just had an update in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and it has not been rising over January so far. What we have just seen in terms of the stock market is the Nasdaq posting a downside key reversal. Now, this, you do have to get the magnifying glass out to see it. And I think that's one of the more important points, that it did close below the low of the previous session, but really only just, and it was off the lows on the day. Therefore, it is going to require clear downside follow-through next week in order to confirm a peak of near-term significance. I don't think there's anybody who is looking at the market right now and thinking that we don't have a short-term overbought condition. We did have a mild pullback at the end of November, and that is probably, I think, an approximation of what a normal consolidation would be inside this advance, which would suggest that if we're going to have another normal size reaction within this incredible and very persistent advance, then 9,000 should offer an area of support. If it doesn't, then that raises the scope that we are going to get a full mean reversion, and that mean reversion could take us back down to test the upper side of the underlying trading range. When we think about liquidity-fueled markets, then you get the kind of liquidity that will fuel a big move because central banks are worried. And we've had the pop on the dollar, and we've had a pop in the precious metal markets, and certainly if we just simply look at the price action in the government bond markets, then this does look like a firming scenario where even prices here are bouncing from the region of the trend mean and breaking the sequence of lower rally highs. Therefore, there are factors that could stay the Fed's hand. The big question is, to what extent are they going to continue to lend liquidity to the market? The reality today is the Federal Reserve panicked when they saw that the balance sheet of, or sorry, the repo market seized up. And they also panicked when they saw that the high yield market seized up. But that was back in December of 2018 when yields got up to about 500 basis points, spreads got up to about 500 basis points. 500 basis points does tend to be a bit of a Rubicon. And when yields start to surge through 500 basis points, it's usually not great news for stock markets. So we briefly got above that level, and then we started to see interest rate cuts coming through, and then the size of the Fed's balance sheet expanding again in September. Everybody knows that there is a huge quantity of debt that is sitting in just above the junk bond rating. Half of all investment grade debt is one notch above junk. And any significant deterioration in the economy could see a wave of defaults, or excuse me, a wave of downgrades. Ultimately, that could result in defaults for some of the riskiest credits. But what is particularly interesting is the fact that high yield spreads right now are back on the lows put in between 2016 and 18. And this has been a phenomenal move. The fact that this assistance that's been lent to the repo market has contributed to a massive contraction in yields. Well, obviously, they're trading pretty rich. And with government bond yields now starting to come back down, that is likely to put some upward pressure on some of these spreads. What I found particularly interesting, and I did post the double line discussion yesterday, was Jeff Gundlach's contention that it is the double B portion of the high yield market which is most richly valued. Of course, one of the most famous of issuers in the high yield markets, and particularly in double B, is Netflix. And if we look at one of their bonds, then we can look at the chart of the yield. And this is a callable bond. I probably should have looked at a bullet bond, but the yield is now down to about 3.2% from 3.7 about a year ago, and the trend in terms of compression in yields remains a very significant factor. So that is a clear example of the bidding up process that has gone on in what are essentially really quite bad credits. I think that's perhaps the most important point. Netflix is spending money hand over fist. They have to continue going to the market to borrow more, producing the quantity of shows that they have on the slate is inordinately expensive, and then they're of dubious quality, but of course that is a question of taste. But the reality is that growth has pretty much stopped in North America, and it is continuing to pick up in the emerging markets. But I think logically the only reason that it's still picking up internationally is because they don't have a lot of streaming competition. When the competitive forces that are inhibiting growth in North America start to move international, then that does really spell a death knell for Netflix. And it is the kind of move that we could see in the credit markets, which would eventually put paid to the trend in people expressing confidence in the share. Now, we've had a major loss of trend consistency on Netflix, but it is being supported by the continued compression of yields and the demand for bonds with a reasonable yield in this environment. Quite whether 3.5% or 3.2% on a double B can be considered reasonable is rather beside the point. The reality is that there is a clear demand for yield out there, and this is something that is likely to persist as long as the Federal Reserve is actively adding liquidity to the market. But at the other side of that equation is that if the Federal Reserve thinks that the uptrend that we've had since October is going to persist, and that the low volatility condition is going to take care of itself, then they're probably badly mistaken, and that we could quite easily have a great deal of volatility, and a pullback of in the order of 10% would take the NASDAQ back to the upper side of its underlying range if liquidity starts getting taken back out of the market. The reality today is that the Fed's action to support the repo market was a stopgap measure. The only way that liquidity is going to return to that market is if they abandon the tightening of regulations. But tightening of regulations is something that is incredibly cyclical in nature. The loose regulatory environment that basically allowed the credit crisis leverage ratios before the credit crisis to go to where they were was because of loose regulation. So the natural reaction is to over-regulate, and that's exactly what's happened, and a clear effort to de-risk the banks. But that is obviously to ignore one of the vital functions that banks perform in the economy, which is to provide liquidity and to aid in the price setting environment. The Federal Reserve really shouldn't be doing that. That's not what the Federal Reserve is supposed to be for. Most particularly, it was a point that Jim Bianco made, was that the Federal Reserve is offering repo at exactly the same rate as the market. So borrowers have a clear incentive to simply deal with the Fed. They don't have to go to the repo market. And that is creating still a bad liquidity situation. There is no prospect of banks getting looser regulation in a political environment such as we have today. MiFID II has only just been imposed, and the range of additional rules that it has imposed, whether that is relating to the quantity of cash that can be held, the kind of debts that can be taken on, the kind of speculative trading that banks can be engaged in, even whether they can bundle their research or have to charge for it. All of these factors are creating barriers to the price setting mechanism in the market. Well, obviously, that now that the Federal Reserve have engaged themselves in this action, it's going to be very hard to unwind, and any attempt to unwind it is probably going to met with a great deal of volatility, and it will likely school the Fed that they have just entered another market that they are going to have a great deal of difficulty getting out of. So what we do have right now in the market is the potential for some pause and consolidation. We've certainly had a really impressive advance, and the fear about the coronavirus is starting to I think take an impact on sentiment. I would highlight though that when we look at the fatality rate, it is certainly not as fatal as SARS, and it is nowhere as fatal as MERS. Well, I remember when I was diving in Thailand during the SARS epidemic, and we got back to Bangkok. I think the people that were most worried about SARS and contracting it were the other people that were on the dive boat. What I really didn't see much of in walking around Bangkok at the height of the SARS epidemic was any real concern among the population. I think one of the most important points here is that we do tend to get some very emotional reporting because of the risk. I think it is worth reminding ourselves that China is a country of 1.3 billion people, and they've had several hundred cases. Now, even if it moves up to a couple of thousand or even several thousand cases, we are still talking about a very small proportion of the population. The fact that we have cases in a number of other countries, that's probably more to do with the increasing ability of Chinese nationals to travel, and the fact that it is also a major tourist destination. That is, I think, one of that's probably more of a testament to the vibrancy of the economy rather than any other factor. And now that we have the quarantines, I think it is likely that we're going to have further containment measures, and that this is a problem that can be averted. When we then think about where are we in this cycle, I think it is important to pay attention to the US presidential cycle, to pay attention to the monetary cycle, and to pay attention to what the market is telling us. On the one hand, we had an inverted yield curve, and an inverted yield curve is a pretty good indication that we are in the countdown stage for the next recession. But I think it is worth also remembering that the first inversion in 1998 was very mild. If I just simply zoom in on that period, the initial inversion was in June, and it popped back up and out of inversion in July. So it didn't spend even a month inverted. Well, on this occasion, we really only had an inversion for a couple of days, and then it popped back up. Now, if we then think about what happened in 1998, we had the inversion, it popped up, and then it came all the way back down, and we had a much bigger inversion in early 2000. But before the eventual peak in the stock market and the initial inversion, the market went up 50%. Between the initial inversion in 2006 and the market peak, the market went up about 30%. And so far, the market's up about 15% off the lows. I think perhaps it's also worth reminding ourselves that it's the NASDAQ has been the major beneficiary. And if we look at how much that index has risen since the 26th of August, it's up, in fact, 24%. So we're not far off the kind of move that we had subsequent to the inversion in 2006, although on this occasion it has happened really much faster. Now, the yield curve is contracting again, and I think that's meaningful. We are potentially back in a scenario which is quite similar to 1998 and 1999. And, well, we have to remind ourselves, well, what was the characteristic that was most common in 98 and 99? It was acceleration. We had these phenomenal accelerations in companies, and that is equally true today. The Apple share price has more than doubled in the last year, and this is following what was already a very impressive advance. Now, I think there is an argument for looking at a logarithmic scale chart at these levels. Now, one of the points that many people will make, and it is valid, that a logarithmic scale chart does hide the acceleration. But one thing we can certainly say with Apple is that on every other occasion when it has been this overextended relative to the trend mean, and the trend mean on this occasion is a 1,000-day moving average, then it has, over the course of a few months or over a year, completely unwound the overextension. But the other point is that each one of these ranges is pretty much above the last. What that suggests is that the price should find support around $230. That would still represent only a 50% unwinding of the overbought condition. And that really does, I think, tell us how fast the price has risen over the course of the last 12 months. There is a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean. This is acceleration by any definition. And it is basically pricing in that the potential for upside is unlimited. In fact, I saw today a news story. It's probably right on the top of the news, that Apple's biggest bull sees the path to a $2 trillion valuation. Well, what that tells us is we are at the point today where there is the scope for investors to compete for the biggest forecast. And a doubling, or well, I guess it's not quite a doubling considering today that the market cap is 1.3 trillion, or nearly 1.4 trillion, but another 40% advance in the price from an accelerated peak already, that's the kind of thing that people need to hear. Because if you're a new buyer, and you're coming into an accelerating market, you can't simply believe that the price is going to go up another $10. You have to think that you're still early and that the price is going to multiply from where you are. And to do other than that would be schizophrenic. The fact about accelerations is that they suck in capital from all over the world. And people will buy all day, all week, all month, all year, as long as they're making money. It's when they stop making money that you then can have the scope for a significant pullback. And that is what we're looking at when we look at these accelerating trends. There are a number of accelerating trends today. Now, does that mean that this bull market is over? I don't think so. I think that we're probably going to have to see a meaningful deterioration in more than one economy in order to really suggest that there is a problem here. But it's going to, I think, in large part be dictated by liquidity. If the Federal Reserve has been frightened by the pace with which some of these assets have appreciated, then they may decide that they need to start shrinking the balance sheet again. Well, if they do that, it is going to unwind all of the advance put in because of the liquidity. I think it is really worth highlighting the parallels we have with what happened in 2017. Now, the total assets of central banks over the course of the last couple of days have pulled back from the 20 trillion level. And that is as much about the strength of the dollar as it is about the unwillingness of the Federal Reserve to continue to add liquidity. But what I'd like to do is show you what's happened in the past, particularly in 2017. Because 2017 was the last time that we had synchronized global economic expansion, and it was bought by almost $3 trillion worth of central bank balance sheet expansion. Then let's go back and look at the S&P 500 during that time, because it was during 2017 that the market started to rise in late 2016, and then it really just kept going. there were a lot of people who started out the year and did not have a chance to buy because it rallied for 3 months into a peak in March. It never came back to test the region of the moving average again. And then it just picked up again in May and kept going. And then we had some acceleration again in the late part of the year. It was, in fact, that acceleration that scared the Federal Reserve. They were worried about overvaluations. That was when Jay Powell came to power, and the market pulled back by 10% immediately afterwards. And everyone rationalized it, thinking that there was that a pullback was due. Well, the Powell put has now been confirmed, and the willingness of the Fed to act has certainly been confirmed. Every single range we've had over the course of the last decade-long bull market has been completed with an emphatic upward break. And as long as that remains the case, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the medium-term bull market. We do have a short-term overextension. So if we think about the short, medium, and long term in the market, then we have the S&P 500, which is somewhat overbought in the short term. And ranges or explosions waiting to happen. We've had an explosive move on the upside. We've had 1 week on the downside. And that is not enough to really question the persistence of this advance. The big arbiter is whether the Federal Reserve is going to continue to lend liquidity. If they do, then we're likely to see a continued pop on the upside, exactly the same as we had in 2017. If we do get a pullback, then that will be considered to be still quite healthy. And if it comes back to the 3,000 level, I think a lot of people would consider that to be a buying opportunity. If we get a much larger pullback and a pullback of 700 points would be approximately 25%, and that would bring it back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But more important than that, it would be a major trend inconsistency because it would represent a failed upside break. And we have not had a failed upside break in the more than 10 years of this advance. That would represent a major trend inconsistency and from at least a medium-term top formation. I think that is something that when we think about the script, when we think about trying to describe the consistency of the trend to a blind person, that's how we could describe it, that this has been an incredibly powerful bull market. It has been punctuated by lengthy ranges, and those ranges have lasted anything from a year and a half to 2 years. On each occasion when it has broken out, it has come back and tested the upper side of the underlying range for a brief period of time. And then it has broken out and rallied for approximately 2 years. The most recent breakout has been approximately 4 months. So if the trend is going to remain consistent, it could rally for at least another 8 months before eventually rolling over into another medium-term corrective phase, which could last for 2 years. And that corrective phase would likely unwind the overbought condition relative to the 1,000-day moving average. And that's if the consistency of the decade-long trend remains consistent. Now, if it does not remain consistent, it tells us that the interplay between supply and demand has changed. And that would be a very meaningful piece of information against a decade-long, reliable interplay. Now, what has been the most dominant factor in terms of promoting this bull market? Then it has to be the provision of liquidity. And financial engineering has gone as part and parcel of that. The incredibly low interest rates and abundant access to liquidity has allowed companies to engage in financial engineering that simply would not have been available previously. The kinds of buybacks that have been underway, there has been, I think, really great data produced by Ed Yardini talking about the number of shares outstanding. And when we then think about, I created this chart a very long time ago, and I'm not all that happy with the calculation. It does tend to be choppy. But the most important point is that it's above where it was in 2008. And against a background where we've had massive share buybacks worth trillions and trillions of dollars, then the number of shares should be lower than it was before this massive boom. But of course, it isn't. It's higher. That tells us that for all the share buybacks that have occurred, we've had share issuance in the form of options. And that has been a massive compensation scheme for the C-suite of the major companies. So share buybacks have not inhibited supply growth. But the continued ability of companies to buy back their shares against a background where liquidity is ample has been able to support prices, even though the supply of shares remains really quite abundant. This is the kind of point that is going to be important when liquidity eventually becomes scarce. That's not the case right now, but it is something we need to be aware of in future. When we think then about a company like Boeing, they've been cutting corners in terms of the production of their aircraft. Now, the share has been higher over the course of the last couple of days, and it has found at least near-term support in the region of $300, which is the lower side of this evolving range. But the most important point is that it did do spectacularly well in 2016 and 17. And since then, it has been engaged in a lengthy, volatile ranging phase. We have ranging time and size. This does look like an evolving Type 3 top formation. It is going to have to, at a minimum, sustain a move back above the trend mean in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Now, the company did announce yesterday that they are going to restart production of the 737 MAX ahead of its certification by the FAA. That's assuming, of course, that the FAA does acquiesce and give them certification. The problem, of course, is that there are a substantial number of companies that depend on Boeing for their business, and a really quite considerable portion of that business. When we rank the companies that are heavily dependent on the company for business, then a number with a high percentage of dependence on Boeing have got very small market caps. And I am not at all sure whether we're still recording. I think we are still recording because the battery on the computer is still working. But the screens just went off for a second. I think this is an important point. There is the potential that Boeing was very eager to announce that it is going to start production again, for the simple reason that there are a number of their suppliers could be default or could be out of business by the time they get back into production. And obviously that would then represent a rather significant problem. So this does look like a share that is really worth monitoring from the perspective of the health of the wider economy. The one thing that could derail the stock market advance would be a recession. We know we have had an inverted yield curve. That's generally an indication of trouble, anything from 6 months to 18 months out. We know that the first year of the US presidential cycle generally tends to be the worst. The coincidence of those two points suggests that first year of the next cycle, which would be 2021, is probably not going to deliver the kind of investment returns that we've become accustomed to. But it does suggest we have still got ample road to do better in this year, despite the short-term risk of a mean reversion. But I also think we're probably getting some rotation right now. And we've had a phenomenal run already, and particularly in the semiconductors index. And the semiconductors index was well off its highs in here today. AMD has been one of the best performers in the sector over the course of the last few weeks, or I suppose last few months, and it had a large downside key reversal in here today. Well, this is already a volatile share. There is clear potential for additional downside in here. When we then think about what's happening in the oil market, that I think is rather supportive of the view that we're still in a bull market environment. Big bear markets in the energy sector translate into bull markets in the stock market, and we are still in a bearish environment. One thing I find particularly interesting is with all of the virtue signaling that we're getting particularly coming out of Davos, and the concerns that people are voicing about the environment, about global warming, and about fossil fuel consumption, that is weighing on the oil market. There's the additional point that Saudi Arabia has been implicated in hacking Jeff Bezos' phone. That's coming hot on the heels of their assassination of Khashoggi at their embassy in Istanbul. I don't know, and I don't think we're probably going to know, whether the accusations about Mohammed bin Salman and Jeff Bezos are in fact true. But it's largely beside the point, because all it does is highlight that the attitude towards some of the major producers of oil is souring, and souring badly. And when we think about the trend of nationalism that is gripping an increasingly large number of countries, this is not simply about political nationalism, but economic nationalism, and energy is an awfully big part of that. This attitude that we need to continue to depend on oil producers who have got nefarious records in terms of human rights and environmental records to boot is something that is gaining increasing attention. So, despite the fact that oil prices have been coming off for the last couple of weeks, then what we have certainly seen over the last few months is Tesla has been completely resurgent, and despite the fact we've had downward dynamics on a number of other shares, it was relatively steady in here today. That doesn't necessarily mean that it is going to continue to be steady. This has been an incredible acceleration. The first downward dynamic really is likely to signal a peak of near-term significance. But when we then think about some of the lithium producers, they have... Oops, that is the... that's the wrong ticker. Orocobre in Australia has broken its downtrend. Albemarle in the USA has also broken its downtrend, so we have quite a bit of commonality here. FMC is the biggest producer of lithium, but lithium is not its primary business, and it has been really much more steady over the last 18 months than the other lithium producers. Then we've had the pop on the upside by the hydrogen producers, hydrogen focused companies. Ceres Power, for example, has broken up and out of its base in emphatic fashion over the course of the last 6 weeks, and despite the fact that it was in negative territory yesterday, it has unwound much of that decline in here today. What we can see here is that Japan and South Korea are betting more on hydrogen. Europe and North America seem to be betting on batteries. But the trend away from the internal combustion engine continues apace. And that should help to put the accelerating trend in palladium into consideration, because palladium has gone up by about a third since December, and we're starting to see a little bit of reticence to pay new highs above 2400. If we then look at the palladium platinum ratio, I think it really does put into perspective just how high palladium is. It was back in the early 2000s when palladium got up to 1.75 times the price of platinum that it encouraged a lot of substitution. It's not like platinum can't be used in gasoline cars, it's just that the technology has to be improved and certification has to, the process has to also be gone through in order to use platinum instead of palladium. And platinum right now is considerably less than half of the price of palladium. And this is a clearly accelerating trend. When we eventually do get a peak coming in and a meaningful pullback that's visible on the daily chart, then we're probably going to see a meaningful pop on the upside for platinum, because I think it's undoubted that what people are doing right now is playing the pairs trade. That's been one of the facts that has clearly depressed the price of platinum. But an unwinding of that pairs trade could correspond with a significant pop on the upside for platinum. And platinum is a rare metal. Something that I've often found to be an idiosyncrasy of the market is that despite the fact that it is trading at considerably below the price of gold, you still have to pay a premium for platinum, which means that jewelers are making a lot more money from the metal than they let on. But this is, I think, one point that seems to be doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention. It's that platinum is the catalyst of choice in hydrogen fuel cells. And if we are going to see a greater drive into hydrogen fuel cells rather than into batteries, or particularly from the Japanese and South Korean manufacturers, that is going to represent at least a replacement quantity of platinum for what was lost from diesel engines, or demand for diesel engines. So that suggests that platinum is cheap right now. I'm very interested in the continued advance in technological innovation, and most particularly in healthcare. And in just the last week, we've seen news about a new protein being discovered that could act as a vaccine against all forms of cancer, a new treatment for arthritis that could treat a common ailment that plagues millions of people with no effective treatment. The continued capital being invested in Alzheimer's is something as well that has the potential to deliver significant value over the long term. Energy nationalism, the investment in alternative sources of energy, regardless of whether that is going to be fusion energy or modular reactors. That was something that we saw also this week, was Rolls-Royce, that they're looking at building at least two small reactors in the UK. This is one of the things that I think is rather encouraging about the new Conservative government in the UK, that they are intent on pioneering support for the technology sector. The UK has benefited enormously from the state investment in the pharmaceuticals industry, and the UK as a result has one of has really a world leading position in the development of pharmaceuticals. Investing in alternative energy to provide energy independence is something I think we're going to have a lot more of, not least because it's something that people understand. It should become a national priority, particularly when the people that you have to deal with in order to import energy are those that one would probably not, in normal circumstances, want to have conversations with. I think these are some of the factors that are clearly driving the conversation and the mood. And if the additional concern about the environment is twinned with energy nationalism, then that is likely to represent a very important trend. It's likely to continue to be bearish for oil prices, because any great uptick in demand for alternatives to oil is likely to inhibit supply. So, and particularly expensive supply. I think that's really very clear. The fact that natural gas prices are as low as they are is also supportive of the evolution of a hydrogen sector in the near term. Eventually, natural gas won't be the primary feedstock for hydrogen, but the fact that it is now back below $2 is, it might be oversold in the short term, but it's one of the only commodities that is, in fact, right back on the lows put in over the last decade. I think the biggest risk out there right now is that China has a lot more difficulty containing the coronavirus than we currently think is possible. I think that's a significant risk. If that has an impact on the growth of the economy, then that is something that could represent a significant risk. It's something we have to monitor. The continued willingness of central banks to supply liquidity in that kind of eventuality is going to be key to whether we get a short-term correction or we get a medium-term correction in stock markets. Right now, we have accelerating trends in a significant number of large cap shares, and that has been promoted as well by the continued and growing popularity of passive investment strategies. Passive investment strategies are both earnings agnostic and implicitly momentum strategies, because they don't pay any attention to the quality of companies. They do pay attention to how large a company is, and the vast majority of stock market indices are market cap weighted. Therefore, the massive quantities of cash that are moving into passive strategies just represent additional flows into the largest shares in the world. It's particularly interesting that it is the three largest companies in the world and also represent the biggest constituents of the indices have been breaking on the upside, but the fourth largest hasn't. And Amazon has failed to break upwards to new high ground. It has been consolidating over the course of the last month in the just above the trend mean, but it needs to push back above the 2000 level in order to demonstrate a return to demand dominance. And of course, Amazon is heavily dependent on the consumer. One factor that I think is important is that it was the consumer was the champion for growth in the USA last year, and jobless growth, or excuse me, continuous jobless claims popped on the upside last week, pulled back down again this week. It does tend to be a volatile measure, but the trend has lost momentum over the course of the last 18 months, and the pullback and the drop in jobless claims this week is certainly encouraging. If, on the other hand, we start to see this breaking on the upside, then and sustaining the breakout, that would be something very different. That would be, I think, a clear indication that we are in the latter stage of a bull market. But there is the world of difference between a short-term market, a medium-term market, and a long-term market. Secular bull markets on stocks can last for 20 years. And the pace of technological innovation is so incredibly impressive with the, I think, really the advent of artificial intelligence and big data and the data economy generally, the pace with which commercialization is occurring is rapidly increasing. And that does hold out the potential for additional upside. When we look at the longer term perspective, this has been liquidity fueled. But it's hard to imagine how central banks are going to get out from supplying all that liquidity. If we have energy prices which are not surging on the upside, which are instead range bound, then that removes a tax from consumption. If we do get meaningful improvements in healthcare, then that represents another removal of a tax on consumption. If we do in fact get autonomous vehicles, that represents the removal of a tax on transportation. And these are incredibly meaningful potential outcomes. So there is no secular bull market that isn't punctuated by the odd recession. We know what the response is going to be to any significant slowdown in economic activity. The big difference that we have today is that the Federal Reserve has demonstrated a willingness to predict economic slowdown and to act accordingly in order to try and avoid it. Well, that's likely to contribute to a bubble. I think it would be rather rash to say that the bubble has already ended. I think all we see now is a short-term overbought condition. There is the clear potential that we are going to see a significant appreciation if the Federal Reserve continues to supply liquidity. So that does represent the thing we need to monitor most closely. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.